Off the ball.
Rugby.
Checkers, rock and roll. And for better or worse, the sport likes its entertainment now, and Michael Checker does that very well.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Off the ball daily.
Now then, we need to talk about Roy. The keenification of modern Ireland is Dave Hannigan's new book. So it explores a whole range of themes from the society in which Roy Keane grew up to how the Irish takeover at Sunderland sort of represented the worst of the Celtic Tiger here in Ireland, and a whole range of other topics. It's a fascinating read. Very happy to say that Dave Hannigan is with us on the line. Dave, how are you doing? Good to chat to you.
Good to see you, Owen. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for coming on. So I think a good place to start is actually on that phrase, keenification, because when I think of the keenification of the modern world, I think about the keenification of the online world, how Roy Keane as a meme is almost his most important and most significant imprint on our world today. And I don't mean meme in an insulting phrase, because I know some people can take it in the pejorative instantaneously, but that was my prejudice before reading this book, that's what the keenification of modern Ireland and the modern world really is.
Yeah, it goes back. I mean, my use of that term would be like, you know, I wanted people to think that there wasn't like some boring history book, you know, that it was much more tongue-in-cheek appraisal of Roy Keane and his influence on Ireland, which is undeniable, like the influence he had on Ireland in many different ways, and Irish sport, not just football, but rugby too. And then his transformation into the character that you've just described, like the grey-bearded influencer, the snarky kind of football's Jeremy Clarkson, dishing out the bar on the overlap and becoming a viral sensation on just about a weekly basis.
Yeah, it's a remarkable thing how he is that viral sensation on a weekly basis. Like, is your conclusion that his ability to be one of the most important football influencers is a complete accident, or is there method to what we actually see in terms of the caricature of Keane?
I think there's two things at play here. He has credibility because of the footballer that he was, you know, because he has become such a, you know, content creating machine now that people sometimes forget, especially younger people, forget what he was as a player, how influential he was, how important he was on that great Manchester United team, arguably the best and most vital player on that team for about a decade. So that's the first half. He brings credibility, but also he brings wit and sarcasm and a sharpness of tongue that others in the English game don't seem to have, you know. And again, you know, I don't want to be wrapping the green flag around me here, but I think it's an Irish trait. Like, we have that natural kind of quick-wittedness, the ability to come up with a fast put-down, competitive quipping, as I call it, you know, that a lot of Irish people pick up in pubs and in workplaces. And Keane has the credibility of a legendary player, and this incredibly sharp, fast tongue that I think sets him out from all of his peers, even in the pundit game.
Yeah, like, in many ways, he is a continuation of Giles and Dunphy in that way, where a more caustic and honest appraisal of Premier League football in particular is coming from somebody who is naturally an outsider.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we always took great pride in Giles and Dunphy because it was different. It was like the honours paper. Like, it was a higher level of football analysis than the trite cliches that we would get in the English game. Now, I don't think Keane is on that level in terms of the in-depth analysis, but he's certainly refreshing in terms of he's willing to pinprick the pomposity of the English game. And, you know, he's willing to call people out in a way, especially English internationals, who are always kind of sacrosanct and untouchable for some pundits. And Keane doesn't play by those rules. And his willingness to do that makes him stand out from the crowd.
You can wrap the Irish flag around you here, or you can wrap the Cork flag around you either, Dave, because that's one of the really interesting parts of the book. And there are a multitude of different examples where you bring your own first-person experience into things. I think maybe a good place to jump off on this is the 1980s in Cork. Cork and, I guess, a section of Cork in Mayfield, where unemployment rates are unbelievably high, where life is tough, where Housing estates are built without many social amenities. Obviously, a community football pitch becomes a key point in the Roy Keane story that has been well told. But your own lived experience of Cork, of growing up in and around Cork, is a very similar one to Roy.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up across the city in a place called Toker, where Dennis Irwin also grew up, which was a working class suburb, you know, lots of houses built by the corporation at the end of the 60s and the early 70s, without necessarily furnishing those areas with the amenities that were required. We are all products of the environment that shaped us. And Keane, you know, the driven Keane, the character who refuses to accept defeat, the relentlessness of the competitor Roy Keane on the field, you can see his forge there. Because, you know, in the 80s in Mayfield, he had very little prospects, as most people did back then. There wasn't great promise in Ireland in the 80s. This is not just a Cork thing, and not just the north side of Cork thing. This was a thing across Ireland. You know, we were being told in school, like, you're heading to Boston if you're lucky, or Berlin or Britain. You know, you're going to one of these places. You know, there's a wonderful quote in the book by Conall Creedon, the great Cork writer, about, you know, the scene on Patrick Street, the lights falling down and kind of almost tumbleweed blowing down the main street of the city, because everybody, all the young people were heading off and all the old people were being laid off by Fords and Dunlops and Verome Dockyard. And it was a really bleak, bleak time. And you know, I'm obviously the same age as Roy Keane, so I remember that. You know, I remember my father being laid off by Pfizer's chemical factory. And, you know, these are life-altering experiences, and they stay with you. So when Keane, you know, became this character on the great stage that was the Premier League, who would not accept defeat and, you know, was putting his body on the line, you can see why. Like, he left a place where he had very little prospects, was given this glimmer of a chance by Brian Clough, this gamble that Brian Clough took on him, and he was never let that go. You know, he was never going to relinquish his shot at a better life.
You make the parallel between Toker and Mayfield there, and some really fascinating details that you write about, like the way in which people viewed those places, and I guess the expectation of how those places would be viewed. Things such as applying for jobs and maybe writing down the address of one of your relatives if they came from a quote-unquote better part of the city.
Yeah, that was a very common thing. And we were told that in school too. Don't put down where you're from. And we thought nothing of it. And then it was only when I was writing this book, I'm like, geez, that was a terrible thing to tell people. You know, this is terrible. Yeah. Like, the street, don't put down the street that you live on. Put down your aunt's street if she lives in a better neighborhood than you, because, you know, you've got a better chance of getting the job. So that's a small kind of detail that has stuck with me and really made me feel like, you know, There's a lot to unpack in that, in terms of inadequacy and, you know, belonging and all these kind of things that you could explore with that. So, like, and you know, Keane talks about in his own book, you know, being 16, I think it was, George Best comes to town to open a bookies shop, because that's what celebrity ex-footballers needing money did in the 80s. And Keane is unemployed and he goes along with his dog to wait outside the bookmakers and lines up for a shot to get a photograph with George Best. And, you know, that was, what else was he doing at 16? He'd left school. He played at the weekends for Rockmount. But other than that, you know, there was no great hope for him.
Yeah, that parallel you draw as well is between Roy Keane, who never really would have seen Best at his peak for Manchester United, being in awe of this guy, which kind of mirrors young people today queuing up to try and meet or get a picture with Roy Keane or get a slice of the pie when they obviously have not seen Roy Keane play at his peak either, those who are 20 years of age and younger. Like, you mentioned Best there, and it does kind of trigger a lot of the themes that we spoke about when we were talking about the documentary with Brian Redden that was aired over Christmas, in terms of George Best coming to Cork and playing, and that era of Hibs and Celtic in the city, and how George Best coming over here kind of represented, you know, the greatness of those two clubs, where they were at, but also the excesses of those two clubs and maybe the boom that was existing at that point. But also that documentary tells the story of the bust in the 1980s and the loss of jobs in the 1980s and Cork Celtic going under early in the 1980s as well. So you bring that into proceedings when this is Roy Keane's, you know, I guess, formative era when it comes to being a man and crucially a footballer. The soccer landscape in Cork was drastically changing as Roy Keane was finding an awareness about life.
Yeah, and it wasn't, you know, there were great players in Cork at that time in every age group, and he obviously was one of a number of players on the team that he played on, Rockmount, that were perceived to have great talent and you know, great potential. But it wasn't a beaten path to England. You know, getting to England was not an easy thing, and it was, you know, it was perceived as well that it was more difficult to get there from Cork than it was from Dublin. You know, Dublin was more a well-trod path across to England than from Cork, and also I think, you know, in Cork we definitely had a chip on our shoulder. We believed we weren't getting a fair shake economically. We believed, you know, I know Roy Keane and players like him believed they didn't get a fair shake from FAI underage selectors, and there was kind of an orneriness about that and stuff. So yeah, like the world of football in Cork in the '80s was bleak. Cork City came into being, and they were struggling. They were bringing over Terry McDermott, Ian Callaghan, the great Liverpool player came across. But yeah, it wasn't a thriving industry in Cork in the '80s.
Insurance isn't one size fits all. That's why drivers have enjoyed Progressive's Name Your Price tool for years now. With the Name Your Price tool, you tell them what you want to pay, and they'll show you options that fit your budget. So whether you're picking out your first policy or just looking for something that works better for you and your family, they make it easy to see your options. Visit Progressive.com. Find a rate that works for you with the Name Your Price tool. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The us versus them attitude then between Cork and Dublin in particular, is that something that Cork people would have held on to in terms of their view of Roy Keane as the years went by, that it strengthened their love, your love of this player, or was it a little bit more complicated than that?
I think it was more complicated than that. I think for a lot of Cork people, there was a sense of like, you know, Roy Keane belongs to Cork, and of course he's being done wrong by the people in Dublin, and you know that he's not getting a fair shake. In the first great Roy Keane controversy, which was the 1996 US Cup that he didn't go to, you know, I remember a lot of Cork people that summer being really aggrieved at some of the coverage of him and how negative it was. But equally, in Cork in the 90s, there was a lot of jealousy of Roy Keane, because he was enjoying a financial success that was far beyond, you know, any athlete that we'd ever produce. I mean, we had our heroes, Jimmy Barry Murphy, the one true god of Cork sport, you know, Christy Ring, if you go back further. But Roy Keane was not just a successful athlete, he was an incredibly wealthy person, you know, and there was a little bit of jealousy among some Cork people about that, and a little bit of begrudgery about it.
Yeah, which is a very Irish thing, not just a Cork quality. It's fascinating, though, to wonder, you know, if you compare Roy Keane to Jimmy Barry Murphy, why Roy Keane will never find the same level of unconditional adulation from Cork people. And maybe one of the reasons is that amateur ethos that you described there as, you know, as part of being a GAA player. But like, if you turn back the clocks further, as you point out, Christy Ring kind of had a more Keane-like quality in terms of how he was viewed, and he had a bit more of a complicated aspect. Maybe JBM is just an unfair comparison for any sporting individual that comes from Cork.
Look, you can't compare anybody to JBM because he carried himself in a certain way. He lived his life in a certain way on the field and off it. The humility of the man, the classiness of the way he played football and hurling. You know, JBM is just, you know, beyond the beyonds. Like, he is, as I said, you know, we believe in one God, the Almighty, and that is JBM. Like, there was much more of an edge to Ring, much more complicated. Lot, you know, I tell the story in the book by way of, you know, comparing Ring and Keane, of Ring being mocked by UCC students on Patrick Street, and Ring telling Brown Don O'Hare, you know, there's people in this city who want me up in the madhouse all week and only brought out for games on Sunday, which is much more of which makes it much more similar to Roy Keane than JBM ever would be.
Yeah, it's a great call. I presume that's from Over the Bar.
It is. That's from Over the Bar. Brown Don O'Hare describing the scene with walking down the street, walking down Patrick Street with Christy Ring.
The idea that no one outside Roy's own family really knows Roy Keane is something that you put forward in this book as well. Do you think we potentially know more about him now than we've done at any other point? Well, obviously we know more about him now than we've done at any other point, but do you think we are now at a point where we know the real Roy in terms of the podcasts that he's done over the past couple of years? We're getting weekly insights into him, that the sort of whims of the man are more exposed now than they were even 4 years ago, let's say. Do you think that's up for debate now, the idea that we'll never get to know the true man?
I don't think we'll ever get to know the true man, but I think he's much more revelatory now than he ever has been. And it's like, it's not just in the podcast, but it's in those off-camera moments, or, you know, when the light is off and they just, you know, shoot them hanging around the place, you know, before they start filming. And you see him revealing more about himself and, you know, stuff like the photograph of his parents at a Wembley Cup final from the 90s. And he's showing it and there's tears in his eyes and he's bringing in contracts and discussing the inner workings of contracts he had at United. And you're like, God, I could never have seen that. You know, that would have never have been something I would have seen Roy Keane or imagined Roy Keane doing one day for the benefit of the public, you know, for that anybody can watch and see this. So the guard has come down in that respect. And, you know, his family have featured, or his daughter has featured on an episode, and, you know, much more letting us kind of glimpse his life in a way that he's kept jealously private for most of his career.
One of the things that he doesn't like to go back to too much, unless it's one of his after dinner stories that have often popped up in the podcast as well, as Roy and his interaction with alcohol and his relationship with alcohol. Talk to us about the chapter that you've written on this, because this is where there's a wider look at Irish society and I guess how Roy Keane probably became captured by the prevalence of alcohol early in his life and struggled, despite living in England for the best part of a decade, to shake that off until he was roughly 30.
Yeah, and he does a lot. Like, again, you know, to go back to the product of your environment stuff, like, drink was everywhere in our childhoods. You know, it was part of the furniture, you know. And so when people grow up then and develop an affinity for it and a problem with it, you know, they didn't pick it up off the ground, so to speak, right? But in Keane's attitude towards drink, there's stuff that struck me as I researched it, and that was a very difficult chapter, the most difficult chapter to write, because it's a sensitive topic, is there's so much of everybody else in him. And just one thing that struck me was him when he's recovering from injury, he used to go out on a Sunday afternoon to an Irish pub with his wife and a couple of friends and listen to Irish music, which is the most classic Irish immigrant thing to do, you know, like maudlin Irish folk songs that mightn't be your bag when you're living in Dublin or Cork or Kerry or whatever, right? But when you're away in Boston or Manchester or Berlin, that they may actually, you know, they may hit different. You know, they do Spancil Hill, for instance. Never taught anything of that song until I moved to America. Spancil Hill has the capacity to reduce me every time I hear it. But Keane, you know, the idea of like go to the pub on a Sunday afternoon, have a few drinks, listen to Irish music, you know, pining for home is kind of almost the implied vibe, you know. That to me, his relationship with drink in that space in his life, at that time in his life, is classical for a lot of Irish immigrants who end up in bars far from home, kind of weeping into their drink, regardless of how well they're doing in the other country.
It is combined, though, with a fairly huge prevalence of alcohol in English professional football dressing rooms.
Oh, well, when he joined, he was out drinking the night with the reserves the night before he played at Anfield, before he made his debut at Anfield. No, that wasn't his fault. He didn't ever think he was going to be playing at Anfield on the following night. But absolutely, drink was everywhere in football at that point. I mean, that was part of the culture. Like, you played hard, you drank hard. You know, the players went into the bar after the game, right? There was, you know, the players' lounge. They went drinking after the match immediately. No, I don't think that's the way it is today, but that's the way it was. And he grew up with that. And then he went to United. He had, you know, Forest was good for it. And then United had its own drinking culture, you know, had it for years. And he bought right into that and climbed right aboard with that in Manchester. And it almost derailed his career.
It's something he seems to bristle at whenever this conversation is brought up. It doesn't seem to be broached too much anymore, as I've said, but he certainly finds it a topic of personal insults for people to suggest that there was anything beyond, you know, maybe a mildly unhealthy relationship with alcohol going on.
Yeah, he's a very complex in that way because he one moment he will speak so insightfully about drink, and you'll go, wow, that's a really profound commentary on the place of drink in somebody's life. And the next minute, as you say, he'll shut it down. You know, I was not an alcoholic. You know, he's adamant about that. He always wants that to be part of the record. So it's a very complicated relationship between him and drink. And again, you know, as you said in the question, like Ireland's is, you know, we have, as a country, we have a complicated relationship with drink.
Yeah. You explore that by looking at another great Irish sports person in Aidan O'Brien. And I actually hadn't seen this interview that he did with Róisín Engle a number of years ago. Talk to us about Aidan O'Brien and what he's had to say on the subject.
Yeah, Róisín Engle did a piece with Aidan O'Brien. I want to say it was 2012. It was definitely more than a decade back. And she describes him going into a rant about drink and the evils of drink and how it makes people lose control and how the damage it has done. And I remember the day I was reading it on a Saturday morning here, like with my coffee, and I'm reading it going, geez, that'll cause a stir. You know, I think there'll be a few, that should prompt some debate. And it was nothing. Like, it was just, you know, it never caused any debate. There was no, it didn't even impact on the media, I think. It was just like a paragraph in a lengthy piece that Róisín did with Aidan O'Brien. And I don't even like horse racing, but I know Aidan O'Brien, I know his place in the pantheon. Like, I know what he represents as a trainer and the success he's had. And I'm like, you know, one of the most successful sports people we've ever produced just came out and said this fairly damning take, or offered this fairly damning take on drink and the damage it's done to Ireland, and it was completely ignored.
Why do you think that is?
Well, see, you're getting me in trouble here now, Owen, because I'm the classic Irish man left Ireland and he's going to tell Ireland what the problem is.
You've got to preach to us now, Dave.
Yeah. This is a whole kind of, there's a Des Bishop routine about this. Americans lecturing us about drink. I have no idea, but it's very pointed to me that it didn't, you know, Aidan O'Brien's a fairly big character in Irish sport. For him to say something like that, I thought, you know, but again, like, let me qualify that by saying that was well over 10 years ago. I would venture from my trips home, and, you know, what I see when I go home is Ireland's relationship with drink has evolved a lot in the last 10 years. And, you know, it has changed, and I think for the better, and there's less, you know, the younger generation don't seem to be as beholden to the pub and to drink as say my generation was back in the day.
It certainly seems to be shifting. I also don't really get the sense that Keane overly regrets his party days. Like, he kind of looks back on those days. He's got, as I say, he's got the after dinner stories, and I don't know, he kind of looks back on them maybe with a sense of, I'd probably do it all again.
I'm not sure if he'd do it all again, but he relishes telling those stories. He relishes spinning those yarns. Like, he loves to go back. And it's almost like, you know, an old fella looking back saying, Jesus, I'm so boring now. But let me tell you, back in the day, you know, I was a bit of a divil. I would do all sorts of stuff. And there's a real, he enjoys that, like, revisiting those days, like the colourful days of his youth, like the wild man days. You know, he definitely gets a kick out of telling those days. Not sure if he'd go back, though, because I think he realized later in his career that he had jeopardized his career and his greatness on the field by being, you know, slightly too fond of the drink.
You interviewed him in 1997 for a piece on RTÉ television. And I think on Keane's insistence, the interview has moved to a pub. So it was kind of around his character when dealing with the media.
Yeah, and I think that was interesting because we had making a documentary about him, and we were talking to a lot of people like Ferguson and Charlton and you know a lot of characters in his younger life who had, you know, played with him and stuff like that. But the big centerpiece was going to be this interview with Roy Keane, and we had booked a suite at Jory's Hotel in the Western Road in Cork, and everything was set up, and then at the last minute it was moved to the back room of the Temple Acre Tavern, which was a pub that his brothers would have played for Temple soccer team, and he would have, you know, hung out there a little bit, and a lot actually in that period of the 90s. So he moved it into the back room, but I think it was more to do with he wanted to be somewhere where he was comfortable, you know, like that it was more comfortable for him. That was a nightmare for the crew who were setting up the cameras and the sound and stuff like that, but it was a comfort thing. But again, that day, Michael Kennedy, his longtime advisor, who was a, you know, very, very powerful and positive force in Keane's life. I remember him calling just before we did the interview saying two things, you know, don't let him have too much drink before the camera rolls, and make sure the Diadora label is visible at all times while he is on camera.
Does he still go back to any of the haunts in Cork when he's home, or is it strictly a sort of swerve the pub entirely?
I think he's I can't say it for certain, yeah. But I think he is far less of a presence in the pubs than he was. But I think he finds out, like a lot of 50 somethings, that when you go back, you know, the fellas you used to go to the pub with don't go to the pub anymore. you know, it's not like when you go back in your 20s and everybody's convening in the pub, and maybe into your 30s, but then people have kids and life moves on, and you know, the pub isn't the centerpiece that it once was.
A couple of other things just to ask you about from this. So Sunderland, as mentioned in the introduction, and like one of the statistics that they don't tell you enough about Sunderland is that they are the first and last Premier League club to have a tent at the Galway races. I mean, this should be brandished on top of their club crest at the Stadium of Light.
Oh, somebody has not made like a drama Sunday evening kind of mini series about this whole thing, the Sunderland stuff. It's such a fantastic story. I know Jonathan Wilson, who's I think was on your show quite a bit. Jonathan wrote a good book about that touches on it. But it's, you know, it's such a fantastic story. Like these property developers and publicans in Dublin buying a Premier League club, like the ultimate Celtic Tiger extravagance. You know, we are so rich now, we're just picking up little pieces of England and buying it, and then putting our most controversial, most box office star in charge for his first ever job as a manager. And just, you know, it's got everything. It's a story with everything. And Keane, to be fair, Keane proves with the Sunderland thing, like that he is willing to change and evolve as needs be, you know, like forgiving or making his peace with Niall Quinn, you know, making his peace with Niall Quinn after the Saipan stuff and then working with him. And also, you know, the story is told in the books. Niall Quinn has told his story in other places about trying to sell corporate boxes, and Keane, like the enemy of the corporate box, walking into a room and persuading all these Northeastern businessmen and women to buy corporate boxes at the Stadium of Light to fund the club. And you're like, you know, there's a real sense of like the guy, he's, you know, he's willing to evolve and change in order to, you know, get what he wants. And there's a moment in that too where the lads, the Drummondville consortium, fly him over in a helicopter to Ireland, and it's like, this is the most Celtic Tigery thing ever.
it's an evolution, I guess, on Keane's character, and I guess it's also a momentary realization of what's practical when you're now the guy wearing the suit on the sideline. Sometimes it's easier to hold your morals and speak into a microphone when you're a player, and your job is a little simpler. As a manager of a football team, I guess he realized the tightrope he had to walk was a little more complicated.
Yeah, like, you know, your principles are fine when you can afford them. You know? At a certain point, you have to sell out. Excuse me, you have to sell out some of the stuff. And it's a matter of, you know, the game, unfortunately, football is entirely about money now. And if you don't have the money, you can't compete. And he was smart enough to realize that, and realize that his celebrity was going to open a lot more wallets than anybody else's in and around Sunderland at that time period.
One of the last things I just want to ask you about is the impact of him on some of the other sports people in Ireland, most notably the Irish rugby team, when they go through the years of becoming a greater force in global rugby at the turn of the century, really. Ronan O'Gara, we've heard him talk about his love for Roy Keane plenty, but Brian O'Driscoll, Paul O'Connell, also right up there in the Roy Keane fan club.
Yeah, like this is really one of the weirdest things about his career. One of, you know, it's a really weird chapter in his career that, like, rugby didn't exist for us in working class Cork in the 80s. And I know some people say, oh, yeah, it did. No, it didn't. It was not a sport. I didn't meet somebody who played rugby until I went to secondary school and I saw this lad in the gym class with a pair of shorts with pockets in them. Yeah. And I'm like, what are those? Why have your shorts got pockets? And he says, because I play rugby. And I'm like, what are the pockets for? I'm like, it was, you know, culture shock. So for Keane to come out of that war, and, you know, the Triple Crowns we won in the 80s, they meant nothing to us. Like, you know, the Irish rugby team weren't coming to the school with the trophy, if there was even a trophy for that, and giving us a half day like the Cork Curlers or whatever. Anyway, so Keane comes out of that world. I mean, as far as I can tell, his only flirtation with rugby was the Rockmount team used to sneak into Old Christians Rugby Field to train because they didn't have somewhere to train, or they did have somewhere to train, but Old Christians was nearer to where they all were. So the manager used to sneak them in there and they'd play soccer. They'd have a soccer training before the rugby crowd got there. So that's the background of it. And then Keane becomes this very influential character in Irish rugby, because all these players that you've just mentioned, great players in Irish rugby who transformed Irish rugby really on the world stage, those men have all talked about how Keane's attitude and his kind of, you know, his refusal to tolerate mediocrity and the tyranny of low expectations that had afflicted too many in and around certain Irish sports for too long. You know, Keane's refusal to accept that motivated all those players to refuse to accept mediocrity in their own careers and in their own sport. And they've all spoken and written so eloquently about Keane's influence on them. And it's extraordinary to me, like, that a working class kid who never played rugby has had that effect. But also, Keane is like Ireland in this respect too, like the country. I know that rugby was not a thing when I was a kid, but I've also witnessed this transformation of rugby, like that rugby became a sport that lots of people who never played it watch it and are into it, and all the numbers for TV games in Ireland. And Keane is one of those. Like, Keane developed this serious draw for rugby somewhere along the way. And, you know, so he is just like a lot of people in over the last 20 years who've discovered this sport and developed a real passion for it.
Yeah, just a great sports fan amongst many, many, many other things. The book is called We Need to Talk About Roy, The Keenification of Modern Ireland. It's by Dave Hannigan. You can go get your hands on it right now. Dave, appreciate your time. Thanks a million for dialing into us this evening.
Thanks a million, Owen. Much appreciated.
Cheers.
Off the Ball Daily.